and welcome to the Free Movement Podcast. I'm Sonia Lennigan, and I'm joined as ever by my co-host, Colin Yeo. Colin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay, although as I was saying just before we got started recording, I'm feeling a bit under the weather. There might be a hacking cough that we'll have to edit out, I'm not sure.
And I should say apologies that we're a little late with this one, but I have just had COVID, which is why we didn't do this last week. I was quite desperate to do it on Thursday straight after the Rwanda decision, but it just was not feasible given how unwell I was. But we are going to start by talking about obviously the big news, which is the Rwanda decision from last week. And then we will go into our normal roundup of the month of October on Free Movement. So Colin, you wrote a very quick turnaround article on the day of the Rwanda decision. So why don't you kick off with us talking about that?
Yeah, sure. So this was my kind of initial take. I've been listening to Lord Reed live or with a very slight delay on the tinternet and so on. And as he started to go through the evidence that the Court of Appeal had considered, I think we all got the feeling that actually the claimants were going to win after all, because my take initially had been that, you know, if the Supreme Court was going to find against the claimants, it would be because they thought that the Court of Appeal shouldn't be reviewing the evidence for itself, basically. So once the Supreme Court was obviously looking at the evidence in its own right, it's, you know, that evidence is pretty damning for the government, the UK government, and frankly, the Rwandan government as well. So we all started to get the feeling we were going to win, and we did. I say we, it's the Royal we. It's like I had no involvement at all in this, and you know, unlike almost the rest of the immigration bar, it was a kind of team of thousands, and a huge amount of work went into this. At least with the victory, those who were representing the claimants will get properly paid for it. Those representing UNHCR not so much, because they're acting pro bono. So huge amount of work gone into all this. And obviously, I think anybody listening to this will be aware of the outcome. You know, the Supreme Court held that Rwanda is not a safe country to send people to. And the basic reason was that there is too high a risk of refoulement, which is where somebody gets sent on back to a country where they'll be persecuted. So country A being the UK, sends a person to country B being Rwanda in this case, and then country B sends that person to country C, which is the country of origin, Afghanistan or Syria or somewhere like that. That's refoulement, and country A can't send the person to country B if there's a real risk of them then being sent to country C. So that was the basic reason. And the way that the Supreme Court expressed itself, I think everybody thinks makes it pretty hard for the government to move forward from here using Rwanda as a safe third country, because the Supreme Court was at pains to emphasize that this principle of non-refoulement is not just a feature of the Refugee Convention, it's not just a feature of the European Convention on Human Rights, it's a feature of numerous treaties, including the UN Convention Against Torture and several others, and it's a feature of customary international law as well. So it's a really important embedded principle. And you know, it seemed implausible that the UK would look to withdraw from the entire framework of international law, which is what we required, really. The other thing that they said that makes it very difficult, really, to see how the UK government can move forward with this, famous last words and everything, but is the lack of reliability of the Rwandan government that the Supreme Court emphasized. So the fact that they're already in breach of numerous international treaties, the fact that they reneged and breached the Israeli refugee deal previously, and the fact that there are no independent checks on the conduct of officials, all of that suggests that the Rwandan government isn't a reliable partner. And that means that, you know, negotiating a new treaty or something like that, which is what the government is suggesting might be its response, it's hard to see how that deals with the problems that have been identified by the Court of Appeal and then confirmed by the Supreme Court here. So it's a really comprehensive win. And it's, we're all kind of waiting to see what the government response is going to be. Have you got any thoughts on what that might be, Sonia?
I mean, I've also seen a proposal that the Home Office goes over there and trains up the Rwandans on deciding asylum claims. I mean, we could end up in a situation where actually the Home Office have been sent to Rwanda and no one else ever goes. The other comment I would make about the decision and just the litigation generally is that I'm definitely not the only one who was really, really unhappy with the way the divisional court handled the case. The interim relief decisions were obviously bad, which is why, as Jed pointed out in his article, we should be grateful to the judge at the European Court of Human Rights who granted that Rule 39 interim relief, which saved that person from being sent to Rwanda. And then obviously the knock-on effect with the other interim relief grants after that. The Supreme Court did criticise the divisional court a few times in the decision. So at paragraph 39, they said several passages in the judgment of the divisional court suggest that the members of the court misunderstood their function. At paragraph 61, they said this was an inadequate treatment of the evidence in question. And then at paragraph 70, in relation to UNHCR's evidence, they said it should not have been treated as dismissively as it was by the divisional court. I think it's also worth noting that one of the judges in this case, Lord Justice Clive Lewis, was issued with a formal warning for misconduct in July, and that was for acting in a rude and hostile manner towards counsel in a hearing to the extent that it amounted to judicial bullying. So I really hope that there is some form of reflection going on among the judges who heard this case, because they just did not handle this very well at all, in my opinion. And it seems the Supreme Court thought the same, although they expressed it a lot more politely than I ever have. The other point I wanted to comment on is just to give a shout out to Asylos, which is this brilliant charity that I volunteer with. And they did a very quick turnaround report on Rwanda. So they work on country of origin information reports. And part of what they do is analyze the country policy information notes that the Home Office puts out. So obviously after the Rwanda agreement was announced, the Home Office put out these country policy information notes on Rwanda, which were hugely problematic. And I think that was sort of obvious from the outset. And the IAGCI, which is the Independent Advisory Group on Country Information, they put out a request very quickly asking for someone to review these Home Office guidance notes. But we knew that that would take a long time. So Asylos was able to mobilize very quickly, get the report out, analyze the SIPINs that the Home Office had put out, highlight the issues with it. And that report was actually cited at paragraph 98 of the Supreme Court decision. I think because it was cited in the report that has been produced by the IAGCI, but it hasn't been published yet, so we haven't seen it. And that's also why that Asylos report is so useful, because it is out there, so we can all see it. So I just wanted to give a shout out to all of my fellow Asylos people and just say well done. That was really good to see. I think it also highlights the importance of looking at what the Home Office is putting out in relation to country of origin information and challenging that, particularly if the plan is to expand the use of the safe country list, which we have seen the Home Office doing recently. That's going to become increasingly important, because I think this case does demonstrate how the Home Office will manipulate country of origin information to their advantage. So it's something that I think is overlooked some of the time, but it's really, really important. I think it's only going to become more important. And yeah, that's it for my thoughts. I think we're on to our October roundup, unless there's anything else you want to add.
No, I suppose just to quickly finish by sort of looking at what the options might be. And it's just that there's been all sorts of briefing. The government, I think, was taken aback by the extent of their loss here, and particularly perhaps by the comments about how unreliable the Rwandan government is as a partner. So I mean, one option is to find a different country other than Rwanda. Another option is to make arrangements that reduce or eliminate the risk of refoulement, so managing the asylum process itself, like you put it, sending the Home Office to Rwanda, which is not something that many of us would disagree with necessarily. Or perhaps, and this has been briefed, some sort of arrangement where if people are sent to Rwanda, the Rwandan government undertakes not to ever remove them anywhere else. But, you know, given they did that with Israel and then did remove them elsewhere, it's quite hard to see how that sort of undertaking or treaty or promise can be relied on. Or, you know, withdraw from the entire system of international law. And just none of those look like they're very likely to happen before the next election. There's not that much time available. Maybe they'll come up with something else. You know, it's hard for us to sort of imagine the depths to which they'll sink sometimes, but certainly looking at it now, it's hard to see how this is going to happen.
Yeah, it's why I just have sort of given up on speculating. I'm just going to wait and see, because there are so many rumors flying around at the moment. It's just giving me a headache.
I think that's wise, Sonia. That's wise.
All right, now on to our October roundup. And Colin, you are going to take us through the Free Movement 2023 reader survey results.
Yes, although only briefly, I think everybody would be relieved to know. So the main takeaway, I think, at Free Movement Towers is that we're doing something right, because there's a lot of really positive feedback, and that was really lovely to see. And occasionally, when I'm at conferences or training courses and things, and people come up and say how useful Free Movement is, we just love to hear that, because it's a bit weird when you're typing this stuff and you're sort of sending it off into the internet and you don't necessarily know what's happening to it and how well it's used or whatever. But so that was all extremely encouraging. One of the other big takeaways for it is that only around 40% of the people who responded to this are actually lawyers. Now, of course, there's always a difference between the number of readers or who the readers are and who the people are who actually fill in this kind of survey. But I'd have thought lawyers might be more rather than less engaged, possibly. But just for Free Movement readers to bear in mind, and listeners for that matter, that we do have quite a wide range of people who are looking at the blog. We've got sort of 2.5 million or so page views per year. So not everything that we put out will necessarily be directly relevant to what you do. And we try to keep everything as kind of broadly interesting as possible for as many people as possible. But we're looking at ways to introduce more specifically targeted stuff, whether it's through articles on the blog, but it could be through podcasts, could be through training courses, things like that. So really just to bear that in mind. And then also to say, before we move on to the next item, that we are looking at changing things. So doing things like more frequent podcasts, that's something Sonia's been working hard on, looking at whether we might be able to improve the processing of our recordings on podcasts, maybe introduce transcripts, things like that. We don't want to commit to things that we don't think we can sustain. And one of our fears with transcripts, or my fears with transcripts, is that we use a lot of funny words, basically case names, person names, that would require manual input into any kind of transcripting software. So we were sort of slightly nervous of doing things that require us to kind of make a lot of effort in the future to sustain things. But we're also looking at revamping the tech behind the website to make everything a little bit more smooth running, make it easier to change things in future, expanding our training offerings, and also we're working at turning all of our training courses into ebooks, which will be free for members, which is something that's kind of fallen a bit off the agenda over the last couple of years since we first launched the ebook. So yeah, we have been looking through that. We've read, I think, all of the responses, and we're working on it, basically, I think is the takeaway message.
Okay, we're onto Asylum now, and you've got the first case, Colin.
Great. So this one is High Court success in challenge to the move of highly vulnerable asylum seeker away from his support network. And it's a really nice judgment. It's a really thoughtful judgment. There's some specific praise for the support worker that was working with this young asylum seeker. It's pretty horrifying reading, like a lot of these are, just the level of disregard the Home Office officials show to the individual circumstances of these human beings. It's really very marked. And this was somebody who had a clear support network in a particular area, applied for accommodation with a lot of backup, sort of evidential backup, to suggest that was really very much in his best interest and necessary. And the government, of course, paid it no attention and simply allocated him accommodation elsewhere on a sort of no refusal basis. So it's a successful challenge to one of those decisions. And it's quite fact specific in some ways, but it's also a reminder that it is worth challenging these things as long as you've got a good evidential basis for doing so. And you might be lucky and get a thoughtful, engaged judge in the way that these claimants did here.
Yes, they do exist. Right, next one is me. Sorry, I couldn't resist. next one is me. Bad news. Over half the people seeking asylum are now unable to access a legal aid lawyer. So this is an updated Freedom of Information request that Jo Wilding has done. She did one last year, and at that point in time, it was just under half the people in the asylum system who couldn't access a legal aid lawyer. So things are obviously getting worse. That is news to absolutely no one who is in this sector. The lack of a good lawyer really has such serious consequences for the whole system. This is why I'm always saying the Home Office should really be one of the biggest advocates for legal aid, whereas actually their position is, lawyers aren't needed. If you have a good lawyer, that means a properly prepared case that is easier for the Home Office to make the right decision the first time. If that doesn't happen, then wrong decisions are made. That further down the line will mean a fresh claim that takes more resource from everyone, that is NGOs, from lawyers, the Home Office and judges. We can't go on like this. It is just not helping with the health of the asylum system generally. The Ministry of Justice is offering a 15% increase for work done under the Illegal Migration Act only. That is obviously completely inadequate and is not going to help, not least because what work is going to be done under the Illegal Migration Act now? Are they going to change anything? It's just, there are so many questions, but that offer is absolutely not good enough. There's not much more to say about it, that at this point, apart from the fact that it's really important that something changes. And hopefully when we have a change of government, they will understand and take seriously the importance of legal aid, and we'll start seeing some investment in that.
Yeah, especially with the number of decisions that are coming through now. That's it's a bit terrifying, actually. So, the Home Office is churning out thousands of decisions a month now, and most of those are grants, but a certain number are refusals, and those people need representation. They're just not going to be able to get it. There's no assistance available. So, there's a really bad looming crisis there.
Yeah, especially if they've been doing all the quick grants first, and I think they did a similar thing with the EU settlement scheme. They've sort of left the difficult refusals for last. So potentially we're going to start, as you said, seeing a really high number of refusals, and a lot of legal aid lawyers are not handling appeals anymore. That's going to be a problem for the first tier tribunal.
Yeah. And it's something to be aware of as well, just generally, is that for several years now, we've seen a very high grant rate that's likely to fall because, once they work through, they do seem to be prioritizing the sort of easy grant countries. And that's likely that therefore the success rate is going to fall as time goes on, and there'll be more and more people coming into the appeal system. Yeah. I think the next item was one for me, I think, wasn't it? Which was just to give a quick mention to, there was a Good Safe Passage report on safe routes for asylum. So if you've been sort of thinking about what that might look like, there's a very useful report on routes to safety by Safe Passage. So do take a look at that.
Next one is me. There's two articles that I'm covering together because they are linked. It is What is a Medico-Legal Report? And then Medico-Legal Reports, How to Instruct and Common Mistakes to Avoid. So I commissioned these articles following a request from someone who responded to our reader survey and said, they wanted more content on Medico-Legal Reports. I really wish I had had this when I was doing these, because I just think these are incredibly useful articles. They've been written by Beth Mullen-Farrows at Helen Bamba Foundation. They explain what the Istanbul Protocol is, the different types of Medico-Legal Reports, how to prepare instructions, including which documents to send and what to look for when you actually get the report. So anyone who is using this type of evidence, which is increasingly needed just because of the way the Home Office is asking for it. So, for example, you look at the guidance around moving to the baby Stockholm, they're really asking for a lot of medical evidence there. The Home Office doesn't like getting medico-legal reports, but at the same time, they are creating a system where they are essentially demanding that level of evidence. This is more and more important, and these articles are absolutely a must read for anyone who is instructing and reviewing medico-legal reports. The next one is me as well. This is New Asylum Processes Set Up on Disputed Territory of Diego Garcia. I mean, this is something that I'm really, really interested in anyway, so I was quite pleased when Duncan Lewis emailed me and said, do you want us to write about this? I was like, yes, I absolutely do. And this was already a really interesting read even before the Rwanda decision, but I think it is useful to revisit it now because of that decision. Essentially, some people arrived in the Chagos Islands from Sri Lanka and they wanted to claim asylum. Diego Garcia was obviously not the intended destination because it has no infrastructure, really. It's just a military base and the people who work on the military base. The Islands Commissioner took legal advice, and although neither the European Convention on Human Rights nor the Refugee Convention apply on the island, the advice was that they could not act in breach of the principle of non-refoulement. So they set up an asylum process from scratch. They used a bit of UNHCR guidance, a bit of Home Office guidance, And what they patched together was actually not great. This article was written on the back of litigation that was challenging that asylum system that they'd set up. And it was challenged on numerous grounds. Permission was granted. And then a few days before the substantive hearing, the commissioner conceded the claim. So all the refusals were withdrawn. And those decisions are then to be remade. In the meantime, these people are living in dire conditions. And as far as I'm aware, it is still unclear what is going to happen to them after, i.e. even if they are granted refugee status. You can't live on Diego Garcia, as far as I could tell from the article. So yeah, it's just really, really interesting and concerning case. Yeah. So in addition to Duncan Lewis, I think Lee Day were involved in this litigation. And I understand from Jed Wilson's might have some clients who are there as well. So I guess it's still watch this space, and we'll hopefully be able to update everyone with the outcomes for these people.
Yeah. Really interesting thinking about that and the Supreme Court decision and the kind of sudden prominence of this slightly obscure word, refoulement. Also, our uncertainty about how to pronounce it. But anyway, moving on.
Refoulement.
I think the next case. Is it not refoulement?
But this is what Lord Reed was saying in the Supreme Court. That's why everyone was tweeting and saying, oh, now we know how to pronounce it. It's definitive right now, refoulement.
Well, I think we can take Lord Reed's pronunciation as being definitive, can't we? So yeah, I should just get over that. Okay, so I think the next one's mine, and it's the title of the blog post is Court of Appeal Gives Guidance on Sentencing for Small Boats Prosecutions. The case is Crown against Chinar, 2023 EWCA Crim 1121, and it's a depressing case, but it's kind of inevitable. And essentially, the court is confirming that the custody threshold will generally be crossed for people arriving in small boats who are prosecuted, and that the starting sentence for the offence is going to be 12 months for imprisonment. I think the max sentence is 4 years, even without any aggravating factors. But you know, if there are aggravating factors, then it might be higher. Aggravating factors might be a particularly bad immigration history of some sort or something like that. And basically, a year in prison is considered to be not excessive in the context of the legal framework here. So it's pretty depressing. And you just sort of think, why? What is the point of this? You know, the prisons are literally full. So people who commit, you know, criminal offences of personal violence and drugs offences and so on, aren't necessarily able to go to prison because there's nowhere to put them. And yet, you know, the government has prioritised sending people who steer small boats across the channel to prison, even though it's accepted that it won't deter anybody. And, it's hard to see what the direct personal harm is to anybody with these things as well. So it's really pretty depressing all round. That's all I've got to say on that one.
Okay, next up is me. And this is Fairness in Safe Third Country Removals, the Court of Appeals judgment in asylum aids case. That may sort of indicate that it's no longer relevant, because obviously we've had the Supreme Court decision now. However, this is still really important. It was Alison Pickup who wrote this article. And she has just explained, so the divisional court, they rejected asylum aids case. They said that there was no right to make representations on the general safety of Rwanda. 7 days was enough time for people to put forward any individual facts as to why they should not go to Rwanda. And access to legal advice was not necessary. I'm not going to go on another rant about the divisional court, but the Court of Appeal rejected those reasons for dismissing asylum aids case. They said that people facing removal to Rwanda have a right to make representations on all matters relevant to the decision, including Rwanda as a safe place generally. People must have a fair opportunity to put forward a case. And importantly, the court said that fairness required effective access to legal representation in all but exceptional cases. They also said the Home Office must publish a policy on granting extensions. Now, the point of Alison writing this article is actually to draw those principles out and remind everyone about the importance of fairness and its relevance to the Illegal Migration Act. So Alison compared the suspense of claims process in the Illegal Migration Act to the Rwanda procedure. And as with Rwanda, the expectation is most people will be in detention. The issues are as complex and as important. And essentially, it was just a reminder that extensions of time are going to be needed under the Illegal Migration Act as well, which is provided for in sections 42 and 43, and also that free legal advice needs to be made available and it needs to be accessible and effective. So I just thought that was a really useful article reminding us all that what the Court of Appeal said in that case does not only apply to Rwanda decisions. I think also, again, I've already mentioned it once, but with the Bibi Stockholm guidance, the first version of that really was probably the worst bit of written guidance I've ever seen. And that did not provide for things like extensions of time. I think the new version of the guidance is marginally better. But again, it's just a reminder that the Home Office does need to be flexible on these things and they do need to act fairly. Next, we're looking at Migration Advisory Committee recommends shortage occupation list is abolished. So we're going to start with the positive bit of this suggestion of the MAC's recommendations, which is that the discounted salary paid to people on the shortage occupation list should go. This really does seem like common sense. If there is a shortage, why should lower salaries be paid, as MAC pointed out? They went on to say that without that discount, the purpose of the shortage occupation list would be diminished to the point that it should be abolished and that employers should use the skilled worker route instead. They recommended that only 8 roles remain on the list, including care workers. Those changes have not yet been made. We are waiting for the government's response, although I think Colin is going to have something to say on that shortly. The issue is people who are in the asylum system who have been waiting for over 12 months and who have got permission to work. It's not like permission to work has been handed out to people as soon as they arrive, which I think is a point missed by many people who are critical of this suggestion. Anyone who has waited 12 months for a decision can get permission to work, but then that is restricted to roles that are on the shortage occupation list. I included a little bit of history in the article as to how we got there. But if the shortage occupation list goes, the right to work is going to be of very little use to anyone who has been waiting more than a year for a decision. I can't see the government doing anything positive to help people in that situation. So it seems to me that the risk is that the right to work will be essentially lost completely. Another point that the MAC made in their report was, and it was good to see that they have taken on this point and are aware of it, but the exploitation of people in certain routes, so for example, seasonal agricultural workers, as I discussed with Jamila from Anti-Trafficking and Labour Exploitation Unit in a recent podcast. So it was good to see acknowledgement of that, but I'm not sure if they have really understood the consequences for people in the asylum system of abolishing the shortage occupation list. And Colin, I think you said that might be happening today.
Yeah, that's one of the rumours I've read this morning, is that it's we're recording this the morning of Jeremy Hunt's autumn statement, and one of the things that's suggested might happen, I think this might be in response to the migration stats coming out tomorrow, is that they might actually get around scrapping the shortage occupation list, which I think like you've just said, I think a lot of us have got no problem with that. In theory, kind of the principle of it seems wrong, but the problem is that it's tied to asylum seekers' right to work, and it'll be pretty disastrous for quite a significant number of asylum seekers who could easily simply lose the right to work in the UK as a kind of side effect of this kind of economic policy change. The events may have moved on slightly by the time people are listening to this. It may be that the shortage occupation list is already toast at the time you're hearing us saying this.
Great. Okay, Colin, next it's you discussing the Nationality and Borders Act and the fishing industry.
So this is a brilliant article by Darren Stevenson. It's a kind of follow-up to a previous article he wrote about the fishing industry. And I think I probably understood this after I'd read it several times, and that was a few days ago, and I'm not sure I do still completely understand it, but it's really interesting, and it's all about the Home Office getting very upset about fishing crews in particular, and this kind of applies to other offshore workers, like to oil rig workers and potentially wind farm workers and things like that. So it's not just necessarily fishing crews, but it's particularly pertinent to fishing crews because of their kind of entry and exit into and out of UK waters. But Yeah, the Home Office got a real bee in its bonnet about fishing crews not having the right visa, basically, and not having work visas. And if the Home Office was so worried about exploitation, then I'd be kind of behind them on that. But I suspect that's not really what motivates Home Office concern in this little situation. They might kind of, suggest that that's what's motivating them, but I suspect not. I think they just get really upset if somebody's not following rules because they think rules should be followed for their own sake. So anyway, the Home Office changed the law. The Nationality and Borders Act introduced Section 43 of that legislation, which has changed the definitions of entry and arrival for certain purposes. And basically, it looks like it's replaced one set of problems with a bunch of other problems, according to Darren. And he sort of outlines various different what sounds pretty common scenarios about fishing boats kind of entering and exiting UK waters, doing certain things like whether they lower their nets or don't lower their nets, or they have to test equipment or not test equipment, whether that then brings them to the wrong side of the law, and how it just sounds completely unenforceable in any sort of shape or form. And it sounds like a real problem waiting to happen. Whether that actually, enforcement might be the key. I mean, maybe this is going to remain a kind of completely hypothetical set of problems because it never reaches court because there's never any enforcement. But if you're interested in fishing crews, you're interested in entry and exit, you're interested in territorial waters, then have a read of that piece. It's a really interesting little sort of deep dive into a pretty obscure area of immigration law.
I think this article was written with a view to parliamentarians reading it. Darren said his last article did get, I think, mentioned some or used in some way there. And actually, CJ got in touch with me pretty recently. CJ's at House of Commons Library now, and he was using the article and was saying something to me about it. So I think that's where the interest potentially is, and perhaps the motivation to try and get it changed. Okay, so the next one is me, and this is Home Office concedes latest challenge to no recourse to public funds policy. I'm really struggling to come up with new ways of saying the Home Office has lost yet another challenge to no recourse to public funds. So this one, the claimant had Section 3C leave as a student dependent. This has been sort of an ongoing issue of trying to get no recourse to public funds lifted when a person has Section 3C leave. And in this case, the claimant was in the process of switching into a human rights route. But that application had not been decided. So in the meantime, her Section 3C leave was still as a student dependent. And the case was essentially about whether the Home Office can lift the no recourse to public funds restriction from any grant of leave. Because obviously, before this case, the guidance provided for it to be lifted from people who had leave on human rights grounds, private family life, and Hong Kong BNO route. The Home Office conceded during the hearing that they did have the discretion to lift it from any grant of leave, which, I mean, why did it get to the point of the hearing? However, I just really want to reiterate that this decision does not mean that it is a free-for-all and that everyone with any form of immigration leave can get the no recourse to public funds restriction lifted. In the article, I've also mentioned the new guidance that the Home Office published pretty much immediately. And that makes it clear that if you are in one of the routes where they expect people not to have access to public funds, and you are asking to have the no recourse to public funds condition lifted, they will want to know why you cannot go back to your home country as an alternative to lifting the condition. So they have no intention of making it easy for people. I think anyone who has a grant of leave where there is a financial requirement really needs to exercise caution before making these requests. It's just not something that people should be doing lightly or think that it is easy following this case. This decision will benefit people who are in the position of the claimant the most, I think. So that is people who are in the process of switching into a human rights route or with the option to do so. There will absolutely be other situations where it is appropriate, but it's not a blanket free-for-all. I just really want to make that very clear because it's an important point, and I would worry about people potentially putting their leave at risk by putting in speculative applications, for example. If possible, take legal advice. even better, go and speak to the Unity Project, who specialise in no recourse to public funds and these change of conditions applications. Sorry, Kaz, that I've just sent everyone to you, but it needs to happen. Okay, so next, I gave you the weird ones this month, Colin.
Weird? Weird? Foreign gamers need a visa to play competitive esports in the UK? That's not niche. It's pretty niche. So it's another really interesting article by Jack Freeland this time about, again, quite a narrow area of immigration interest. But it's basically whether if you're playing computer games competitively, then you need a visa, and what kind of visa you might need. And basically, there is a visa for you. It's the UK visit visa. It does entitle you to win prize money if you're actually very good at this stuff. You can also get expenses, but payments become more problematic, and Jack explains that in the piece. But my main takeaway from this is it just sort of reinforces one of my long-standing complaints about Home Office drafting and rulemaking, which is that the visit rules are insanely complicated and they just don't need to be. You know, all this stuff about, okay, you can't get paid, but you can win prizes, but you can get paid if it's in these circumstances and you've been invited by a UK body of a certain variety. And it's just get over yourselves. You just don't need this level of complexity. Just what was wrong with the old genuine visit rule? Drives me nuts. Anyway, if you're dealing with these kind of situations, that's your kind of go-to reference point.
I suppose I did keep one of the niche ones to myself, but it's because I wrote it up. This is TLS contact in unsuccessful challenge to new Home Office contract. Now, I know from my time at ILPA that there is a small but dedicated group of people who are really invested in whether TLS or VFS are the ones providing visa services overseas. I personally am still not really sure what difference it makes to the end user. Essentially, TLS was trying to prevent the Home Office's new contract with VFS Global starting before this litigation had concluded. So this was interim relief. So I guess there's potentially more excitement to come. But if this is your sort of thing, then go and read all about it.
I think you're inviting contributions to our proverbial mailbag with that kind of loose talk about, oh, it doesn't make any difference.
No, I would love to know.
I'm with you. I don't know what the difference is either. I have to say, I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing. But I gather that some people are quite exercised about it.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw it, I was like, oh no, I'm going to have to read this. Like, someone's going to want it written up. And sure enough, someone did message me and say, can you please write this off? Anyway, yes, very important, maybe. Next, Rwanda is not actually the big news at the moment. This is the big case. Court of Appeal upholds deprivation of citizenship decision. Now, Colin, can you tell me about the views on this thing?
It's been insane. So you've had tens of thousands of views on this particular blog post since it was published. And I don't know why. And the internet's a weird place. You get stats on all sorts of weird stuff, but they've totally failed. I don't know where the traffic is coming from. But this really quite fact-specific and otherwise slightly dull case has been one of our most popular blog posts of 2023.
It was something like 50,000 views in the first day. And as I keep saying, if this is my most read article of the year, I'm going to be very, very grumpy, because actually everyone should be reading the thing I wrote about UNHCR's report on screening. Anyway, this Court of Appeal deprivation case, essentially Court of Appeal upheld a decision made by the Home Secretary to deprive a person of their British citizenship on the fact that it was obtained by dishonest concealment of a material fact. The appellant did not disclose what appeared to be an ongoing relationship between he and his wife in Pakistan at the time he obtained leave based on his relationship with an EEA national. And that's it. So, yeah, that is the big news for the month. Now, I'm just going to mention a couple of articles that we updated last month. One of those is, what are the 10 and 20 year rules on long residence? Because there were some changes there. And then we also, Nick Nason updated his briefing on what is the law on deporting foreign criminals and their human rights. Those are both incredibly useful articles that are now up to date. Hopefully nothing's changed since then. And that is it. That is our October roundup done. Thanks for listening, everyone. Colin, do you want to say bye?
Yeah, we usually try to end with a good story, but we started with one this month. So that's great.
Yeah, No, I'm like, everyone's had more than enough good news for today. We don't need to worry about finishing with something.
On that happy note, goodbye.
Bye.